arvoisat läsnäolijat, tervetuloa väitöstilaisuuteen, jossa maisteri Erik Lee puolustaa liikuntalääketieteen väitöskirjaansa liikunnan ja saunomisen aiheuttamat muutokset sydän- ja verisuonitautien riskitekijöihin. Väitöskäytäjät englannin kieli. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the public examination of the dissertation of sports medicine by Master of Science Erik Lee, titled Alteration to Cardiovascular Function from Sauna Bathing and Exercise and Sauna in Populations with Cardiovascular Risk Factors. Doctoral candidate Erik Lee was born and raised in Singapore, and he was awarded a Bachelor of Science degree in Sports and Exercise Science from Edith Cowan University in Australia in 2015. He then moved to Finland and completed a master's degree in biology of physical activity at the University of Jyväskylä in 2017. And today, he is publicly defending his PhD thesis. The opponent in the public examination will be Professor Hans Hägglund from Uppsala University. He is an experienced clinical researcher in the field of blood diseases and is a senior consultant at the Karolinska University Hospital and an affiliated researcher at the Stockholm School of Economics. He is also a board member of the International Sauna Association. As the custos appointed by the faculty, I declare this public examination open.
Distinguished custos, honored opponent, ladies and gentlemen, a very good morning to all of you present here today. It is an absolute pleasure to be able to speak about a UNESCO-recognized heritage in its own motherland. Few people get the opportunity to study sauna bathing from a scientific perspective. Even fewer get the privilege to speak about the cardiovascular and health benefits of sauna bathing to an exclusive group of people who grew up with the sauna as an integral part of their lives. For that, I am extremely honored and thankful. As a species and as a society, we have evolved from hearsay and old wives' tales to the providence of evidence and facts to substantiate for our continued actions and habits. The changes we make to the way we live and conduct ourselves are often justified by reason and rationale. As such, the burden of proof lies in our collective and individual understanding of the many facets of health and exercise. In so doing, we empower ourselves by understanding the actions of generations past while building the foundation on subjects we have yet to fully comprehend for the sake of future generations. Today, we have a wealth of information on how to manipulate and modify our lifestyles to enhance quality of life, be it meditation in the morning, a quick lunchtime workout, a beer after work with some colleagues, or yoga before bedtime. We have found ways to improve our individual well-being whilst being aware of the benefits and or harms our activity entails. The term research has shown is not only limited to academic writing anymore, but has in fact penetrated the zeitgeist. Yet the subject of sauna bathing for health benefits remains largely underexplored. The sauna has historically been used in the Nordic region, especially in Finland, for a variety of purposes, from the prevention of hypothermia to smoking of meats and even childbirth. Given these wide-ranging practices over a period of more than 9,000 years, it is no wonder that sauna bathing has become an important part of the lifestyle and culture here in Finland. Save for a few unfortunate accidental deaths from the excessive use of alcohol during sauna bathing, this activity has shown itself to be safe for people of all ages, some of us might remember, and quote the sauna bathing competition for its dangers. But those are the exceptions, not the rule. Nevertheless, I digress. Sauna bathing in this region of the world is not only an activity that is undertaken regularly, but it also happens to be a recreational and social pastime for a large majority of the population. In this very room alone, I'm sure that we have easily accumulated more than 1,000 hours of sauna exposure each. Given the extensive use of this immensely satisfying activity, it stands to reason that we ought to develop a greater understanding of how we can leverage it to better our lives. As such, it is often a surprise for many that the study of heat as a form of therapy, particularly regular sauna bathing, and its potential for cardiovascular adaptations has yet to be investigated from a more applied perspective, with a greater emphasis on external validity. One of the earliest studies investigating the effects of repeated sauna bathing by Leppaluoto and colleagues in 1986 found a greater utilization of carbohydrates for metabolism after 7 days. However, participants had to be in the sauna for 30 minutes straight, 4 times per day. Now, some of us may wish to do that, but most of us certainly do not have that kind of luxury. Later research from Japan showed that 2 weeks of infrared sauna use through a method known as Wah-On therapy was able to lower blood pressure and oxidative stress levels. The Wah-On therapy method requires exposure to the infrared sauna daily at 60 degrees Celsius for 15 minutes, followed by bed rest with blanket cover for 30 minutes. For the average person, these methods are somewhat impractical and do not accurately correspond to how the sauna is commonly used. Crucially, the infrared sauna is also incomparable to the Finnish sauna due to differences in key elements between the environments, such as humidity and temperature. Ultimately, this leads to a different overall stimulus being presented to the human body, particularly for blood flow and the cardiovascular system. As such, majority of the studies exploring the use of sauna bathing as an ergogenic aid or for heat acclimation purposes have preferred to use the Finnish sauna. Interestingly, some of these experiments have also found positive adaptations to endurance performance outcomes. The findings of this dissertation are in support of the prevailing literature and were elucidated using progressively rigorous methodologies. In order for us to better appreciate this undertaking, the study designs used will be briefly described, as they could be considered one of the dissertation's strengths. The first study employed a pre, post, and post 30-minute design to investigate the acute responses and recovery to a typical 30-minute sauna bathing session, with a shower in between, of course. A total of 102 people participated in this study. The second study utilized a similar approach with 77 participants. However, the initial 15-minute bout of sauna bathing was replaced with an aerobic exercise in order for us to better understand the adjunctive effects sauna bathing has when performed after exercise. We then conducted a crossover trial where each of our 72 participants performed both the sauna-only intervention and the exercise and sauna intervention on 2 separate occasions. This served as a validation of the results seen from the previous studies. The final study was the first ever randomized controlled trial conducted to study sauna bathing. It had a sample size that was sufficiently large to achieve the requisite statistical power and was carefully planned and executed to account for many potential confounders. In summary, the present dissertation consisted of 5 years of hard work, 4 experimental studies, 3 key findings, 2 sauna rooms, 1 very tired human being, and 0 dating success. Nevertheless, we shall now shift our attention to the findings of the dissertation and its possible utility in our society. All the other points are beyond the scope of this discussion and have been published elsewhere. Firstly, we found that 2 times 15 minutes of finished sauna bathing led to acute positive changes in cardiovascular function for middle-aged adults with cardiovascular risk factors. This was represented by a range of parameters such as blood pressures and vascular stiffness. There may potentially be long-term adaptations to sauna bathing which could be favorable for cardiovascular health. Secondly, by using a combination of 15 minutes of aerobic exercise followed by 15 minutes of sauna bathing, we found encouraging indications for a potential synergistic interaction between exercise and sauna bathing. This was reflected by reductions to a similar group of parameters that we found in the aforementioned study with sauna bathing alone. More importantly, however, these effects were sustained after a 30-minute recovery period. These results were further corroborated by a crossover comparison utilizing a more robust statistical approach. This allowed us to ascertain with a greater degree of confidence that these effects were indeed due to the combination of exercise and sauna bathing. Lastly, the fourth study of this dissertation showed increased salutary adaptations when regular sauna bathing was performed after regular exercise. Specifically, the 8-week randomized control trial found that 15 minutes of sauna bathing after each session of exercise, 3 times a week, was able to enhance the improvements to cardiorespiratory fitness seen from regular exercise alone. More notably, exercise and sauna bathing led to other beneficial adaptations such as reduced systolic blood pressure levels and total cholesterol levels, which were not present after the exercise intervention. These results have wide-ranging societal implications, as heat therapy is a rapidly growing area of study. In addition, sauna bathing has also become increasingly popular internationally. In spite of what has been spoken about thus far, it is important to note that there are still needs in this field that ought to be addressed. Primarily, we need to gain a better understanding of the minimum effective dose for sauna bathing adaptations. Because this enjoyable and wholesome activity, like exercise, requires effort, resources, and time. By continuing our investigation into this area, we could also reduce the barriers to adherence. Additionally, sauna bathing and heat therapy could be used in other aspects of exercise medicine, like cardiac rehabilitation prior to heart surgeries and physical rehabilitation for musculoskeletal injuries. People who are already exercising regularly, especially those in Jyväskylä and Finland, can now take advantage of an additional source of stress to enhance their workouts. Realistically speaking, spending 15 minutes after an exercise session to perform some stretching and flexibility work in the sauna is both efficient and highly feasible. Using sauna bathing as a supplement to regular exercise can therefore be considered a worthwhile investment for one's cardiovascular health. Esteemed Professor Hans Hoekland, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, may I ask that you present the comments on my dissertation that you see justified?
Thank you, and thank you, Jyväskylä University, for inviting me to be an opponent this day. It's a great honor, it's a privilege, and it's a pleasure to be here today. This is a unique day for the sauna research. And going back to the history, I first would like to thank you for this excellent introduction. But going back to the history, as you mentioned, Eric, the sauna was used as a primary healthcare facility. Women gave birth in the sauna. In the sauna, deaf people were just taken care of. It was a warm room, it was clean. But it was also some activities going on in the sauna when it comes to taking care of people. Bloodletting, for example, cupping, and other medical interventions. 50 years ago, at least actually, if you go back 100 years ago, at least in Sweden, the life expectancy was around 50 years. And we took one warm bath annually. So the hygiene was not that good. And this was realized by the government and by the general people, because when people moved into the cities during the industrialism, they lived very narrow, and one big challenge was infection diseases. And that's why the primary healthcare physicians in Sweden was thinking, we have to increase the hygiene to increase the life expectancy and also the quality of life and reduce the number of infections. So what happens was that the primary healthcare physicians, they approached the government and said, we now need to be more, to increase the hygiene. So what happens was that they were looking for money, and they used those money to build 10,000 saunas in Sweden between 1920 and 1949. And why saunas? Because they looked into Finland, and there was not that big of a problem with the hygiene at that time here in Finland. So those saunas was actually built to increase the hygiene and to reduce the number of infections. And there are some that claims that this was actually one reason that Sweden became so successful, because the people could go to the industry, they can work without being sick. So today, cardiovascular disease is one of the major cause of death, but cancer is also a major cause of death in the Western country. And we know that 80 to 90% of all cardiovascular diseases can be prevented, and up to 50% globally of all cancer cases can be prevented. And those can be prevented by improved lifestyle, physical activity, diet, non-smoking, and reduced intake of alcohol. And if you are physically active, if you eat the right thing, if you don't smoke, and if you are limited in your alcohol intake, you can actually improve your life with or your life expectancy with up to 14 years. But there are other factors that are less studied, such as nature, sleep, stress, being social active, and also heat and cold. And that's why I think those studies have been of great importance. So chronic disease are increasing due to that we live longer. And today, 25% of all 15 years and older people in the EU have a chronic disease. In Sweden, 90% of all persons elderly than 65 have a chronic disease. And chronic disease are expensive for the society. And all in EU, in average, each country use 3% of the total healthcare budget for prevention. And again, Finland is best in EU. Finland uses approximately 6% of their budget, healthcare budget, for prevention. Now I think that we have gone from using the sauna for hygiene purposes to wellness, and I think that Eric and his team now have shown us that this can be used also for effectively for prevention. In 2015, Laukan and his group showed nicely that frequent sauna use can reduce the mortality in cardiovascular diseases and also prevent other chronic diseases such as hypertonia, stroke, dementia, pulmonary disease, and other blood diseases such as thromboembolism. Now, I am looking forward to discuss your work, Eric, and this is important, and I'm sure that this discussion will be an educational moment, lesson experience for me and for the audience as well. I think I'll stop there.
That's the first question that is so good that I have no answer for.
Okay. Anyway, I think you have read all the papers and all the results in detail. So, please, Eric, I think you choose to be chosen.
I did.
So, I am, you have mentioned, but I'm curious to know more about your background and how the interest for sauna research started and how you ended up here in U.S.
Don't worry, guys. I'm just taking my time to think. I will answer the question. I first got exposed to sauna bathing when I was living in the US. I was competing in fight sport, boxing, Muay Thai. We had to cut weight. Everybody was using a sauna to do that. So it was a tool, a legal cheating system to get down to a weight that you're not supposed to be at so that you can beat other people up. Outside of cutting weight, I did not really use a sauna. But when I left the US and went back to Singapore, when I started to pursue bodybuilding, I started using the sauna more often, not just for weight cutting, but because I have a very strange condition where after, it only happens to my legs, when I train too hard, I would get severe cramps on both my quadriceps and my hamstrings concurrently, which means that I would either have to lie down or bend my leg in a certain angle so that my muscles will not fire at the same time. It sounds very painful. I can assure you. There's been many times where I called friends to come help me. And they didn't understand what was going on, and they see me walking like a duck, and that happened a lot. I couldn't lighten the intensity of my training for I was competing, but a good colleague of mine at the time suggested that I go to the sauna after training to relax the muscles, and I was an idiot back then. I'm still an idiot now, but I listened to him. I went to the sauna, and it helped. The cramps went away, and then subsequently, I started using the sauna more frequently, not just after leg workouts, but almost after every workout. So that's when my personal exercise plus sauna bathing protocol started. I never imagined that I would actually get the opportunity to investigate that from a scientific perspective. So when I came to Finland and I got a chance to do so with Jari, I took the offer up immediately.
Thank you. So did you end it or would you like to?
No.
First, I would like to congratulate you for this book. The frame story is excellent. Haven't you read the frame story? Read it, because it's a nice summary also of the history. And I would also like to congratulate you for the well-designed study in this book. This morning, the sauna was closed at the hotel. I was surprised. But I went into the sauna yesterday evening. So when I went into the sauna, 60 years old, a little bit fat, stayed there for 15 minutes, would you explain for me and for the audience what happens in my body?
That's a good question. So basically, if we can observe from a physiological perspective. So when we go into the sauna, first, the body takes about three, you can try this tonight, if you're going to the sauna tonight. The body takes about 3 to 5 minutes to actually start its processes to maintain homeostasis. So in the first 3 to 5 minutes, and try this at home, please. It's a very fun experiment. I do it all the time. So if you don't take a shower, you're dry, your body's dry, you step into the sauna. For the first 3 to 5 minutes, you don't actually start sweating. You remain dry, and you almost feel like, oh, this sauna is not very hot. After about 5 minutes, you will feel your body begin engaging the processes of increasing the heart rate. Then you'll feel the onset of sweat. You will see beads of sweat forming on your skin, and that would come back to the fact of vasodilation. So the arterioles will vasodilate, expand, so to deliver more blood, so that you can carry the temperature away via convection through the sweat on the skin. And that usually is a very gradual process. It's not, the onset isn't something that is rapid, and you can actually feel the steps happening as you sit in the sauna. And so it will get to a point where if you sit for 10, you will start to have a discomfort of what I would consider, excuse my French, you will want to bitch out, basically. So you will want to leave because now you can't take it anymore. But then that's not the threshold. I don't want to use myself because I'm an exception, but I have seen people who can sit in a sauna for 20 to 30 minutes straight. Experiments have been designed in such a way that elite athletes for heat acclimation purposes have stayed in the sauna for 30 minutes straight, and it is possible. But by and large, when you get to for an average person who I would say goes to the sauna, let's say once a week, by the time you hit 15 minutes, no matter what the temperature may be, there is a sense of, you will feel signposts. You will feel faint. Doesn't mean that you will pass out, but the feeling is there. And so at that time, usually most people leave. And one of the things we did during the pilot study, and we did many pilots with normal healthy people, with people who use the sauna frequently, with people who didn't use the sauna frequently, and then finally we did a pilot with the group of middle-aged people with cardiovascular risk factors, because we wanted to make sure that people could actually, for the study, stay in the sauna for 15 minutes straight. Or at least at the time I was trying to investigate how long can I torture these people. And it turns out that most of them want to quit at 15 minutes, if not all of them. And it was a very, because I have such terrible finish even till now, it was very difficult for me to explain to these pilot subjects that I want you to stay in the sauna for as long as you can. And they said, yes, of course, we know that, but we need to take a shower, then we'll go back in. And I said, no, that's not how we play this game. It's done now, because I needed to test what the threshold was for the normal person in the average population. So we found out that 15 minutes in that way was the longest tolerable for an average person. Yeah. Your mileage may vary.
So I, when reading those papers, one thing that struck me was that when you read other papers, usually they mention the core temperature.
Yes.
Did you measure the core temperature?
I wish I did. Especially for the first three studies, the acute studies. We didn't have... Now I do. But at the time, I was still a bit green behind the ears, and I did not have expertise on how to insert rectal probes, or how to use rectal probes, or the fact that we can actually set aside a budget to have that. We did measure tympanic temperature, but it was a parameter that we included only later on. So we had already collected a good large amount of data, so it wasn't, if we had all of it, we would have published it, but because we didn't collect the temperature for all of the participants, we didn't, and sadly also, we didn't measure the core temperature with the rectal probe.
So but what is your experience? How much do the temperature rise?
So based on unpublished evidence, 0.5 degrees Celsius after 30 minutes to 1 degree Celsius. So it's between half a degree Celsius to 1 degree Celsius.
So after 50 minutes?
After 30.
30.
Yeah.
And have you measured after 15?
No, we did not.
You think something happens with the quarter?
I think it does. And I want to say that this is pure guesswork. I want to say that after 15 minutes, it probably stabilizes. But I have no evidence to back that up.
So, thank you. It was a nice story about what happens. But what happens with the... We have temperature receptors, doesn't we?
We do.
And what's the Nobel Prize? 21, I think.
Yes, the TRP channels.
Yes.
Yes.
So, where do we have all those temperature receptors? Do you know the frequency distribution?
I'm afraid that is way beyond my capability. So I've seen it, but I have not actually gone down into that area because that is quite the molecular side of things, which I have read about, but I am not well versed in. So I know about it, but I can't really give too many comments about that.
I don't think we have plenty in the face and head, I think. And in those studies, does the participants use a sauna hat?
No, we did. I don't think anyone asked to use. I think the only thing that was a big, that created a bit of a ruckus during all the experiments was the participants insisted on being naked in the sauna. So we told them that the protocol is please wear a swimsuit, you'll be in the sauna alone or with the same gender people, but please wear a swimsuit, and most of them had a hard time with that. Yeah, they wanted to be naked. So, yeah.
How many use sauna have you think in Finland?
Off the top of my head, after visiting several public saunas in Finland, in Tampere, in Helsinki, and here, I want to say that and the crowd, please correct me if I butcher this, okay? I want to say maybe one out of every 20 person. Yeah, that's my most educated guess.
Have you tried to sound happy?
No. Yeah, I don't want to be, I don't want people to put labels on.
But it's nice, I can tell you, you know, because you can, my experience at least is that you can stay longer time in some.
That's correct. That's correct. That's what I've been told. And I choose to use that as a ace in my pocket. In the event that I need to impress someone, then I'll bring the hat. Yeah.
It could be even more preventive, maybe.
It could be.
Yeah.
But there's something very interesting that I had, based on the discussion that I had with a group of researchers out of Coventry University. They were doing hot water immersion studies, so heat therapy. Of course, not directly comparable to sauna bathing, but after some extensive discussions with the PIs of that research group, they have the same, they face the same phenomenon as we did, in the sense that after 15 minutes of sitting in a hot tub, of a warm cup of water, their participants also felt faint and they had to quit. So there is some alignment to the tolerance of heat in a continuous period, even though they may come in different forms. So I don't know if that is a, I don't know if that is something that is worth the community exploring at this point in time, at least for prevention of possible injury risk. I think it's worthwhile, but outside of that, yeah, I don't know why it aligns. And I've also spoken to the researchers in University of Colorado. They also did a lot of hot water immersion studies, and they have reported the same. So usually if they had a longer hot water immersion, they would let their participants come out of the hot tub, take a shower, or sit down, rest, and then go back in.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why either, yeah.
So you write about a typical Finnish sauna.
Yes.
What is a typical Finnish sauna?
Does anyone in the crowd want to help me? No, it's rhetorical. To me, to my understanding of what a typical Finnish sauna is, it has to be built with wood. It has to be of a certain height. So the ceilings are usually not that tall. It has to have a strong stove, a strong kiwas, preferably built by Harvia. And I would say it must be mandatory to be able to splash water on the rocks. Or in the Finnish word, löyly. You must be able to do that. That is what distinguishes, because in Central Europe, as we have found out, that you're not allowed to do that. In the US as well, North America, not just the US, in Canada, there's a lot of saunas out there. You're not allowed to. You need a sauna master. I know this sounds ridiculous, but you need a sauna master to throw the water for you, and do some fancy towel techniques to pass the heat to you. So that's a sauna. I don't take that away from them, but that's not a Finnish sauna. Yeah, because in the Finnish sauna, there's an autonomy. You are, if you want to put water on the rocks, you do it, and if you don't, you don't. We have also run pilot studies on that particular phenomena because, as you know, Hans, after we splash water on the rocks, there is a sensation of mild discomfort, but then there's no actual change in temperature. So you feel it as a result of the steam passing through, but it doesn't actually change the temperature of the room. So in our experiments, we put the bucket with water there, and we say, like, you know, splash the water if you want, don't if you don't. It's fine, but that would be, to my understanding, what would really characterize a Finnish sauna.
And you didn't mention temperature and humidity.
Oh, well, yes. My apologies. So the temperature can vary between 80 degrees Celsius to 100, at least in scientific publications. Now, I've been to saunas that were heated up to 110. Not very comfortable. And the humidity is generally between 10 to 20%. Yeah.
What happens if you increase the humidity?
You will lose the ability for your body to get rid of the excess heat. And so you will not, as the humidity rises, your ability to sweat will be severely hampered, and that would make the heat load a lot greater. That is one of the main differences between the infrared sauna and the Finnish sauna. There is some level of humidity. That is, I know in the nomenclature we say the dry Finnish sauna, but the fact that we can actually put water on the rocks creates some humidity in the room, as opposed to an infrared sauna, where this option is not there. And that also explains why most infrared saunas are programmed to go up to a maximum of 80 degrees Celsius and not higher. Yeah. So the loss or the hampered ability of the body to sweat in order to lower its temperature is probably the greatest difference when we talk about the elevation of humidity.
Which means that if you increase the humidity, you cannot stay that long in the sauna.
Oh, absolutely. No. Yeah.
And I was thinking, you said, were the participants allowed to throw water on the rocks in those experiments?
Yes, they were all allowed. They were all allowed to, and we did not control that, which was one of the problems that initially we had in designing the study, understanding if that would be an influence, and we wondered if we needed to report that in our publishing of the articles. But fortunately for us, none of the reviewers of those articles asked, "Hey, did you let your..." I'm guessing maybe some of the reviewers were not finished. If they were, they would have asked. But we did not control for that as such. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We also did not control for water consumption. Mm-hmm. So they were allowed to drink water at libidum throughout every study. We did not control for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm actually a little bit surprised, because I think 15 minutes is a pretty long time. I'm used to sauna. I go into the sauna almost every day, but 15 minutes, I mean, it's for me, that's the limit. So I'm a little bit surprised that those guys really could stay there. But that was not because the compliance was really good.
Yes,
it was like 97% or something like that.
Yeah, the compliance for the entire intervention. So no one. There was one dropout due to personal reasons, and the compliance was at 97%, in the sense that only two of them missed one session each. So none from the exercise and sauna group.
Okay.
So here's a really interesting story as well. So we raised the temperature every fortnight. So in the first 2 weeks, weeks one and two, the sauna temperature was 65 degrees Celsius. Weeks three and four, it was 70 degrees Celsius. Weeks five and six, it was 75. And then weeks seven and eight, it was 80 degrees. Funnily enough, there were no problems until week seven. The first session of week seven, I had at least five participants knock on the sauna door and ask me, "Hey, is it 15 minutes yet?" Mm-hmm. Whereas prior, they were able to handle the temperature. So up to 75, no complaints. Uh-huh. Yeah. Of course, I did my best to say, like, you know, check the clock, because I was always there outside the sauna. And I would tell them, "Hey, there's only a minute left. Can you please just remaining there, so that we wouldn't have to then start doing some statistical accounting for this. And so they did. But there were a lot, and even in week 8, so one could assume certainly that, okay, week 7, because sudden, you know, it's 80 degrees now, that they felt uncomfortable. Maybe 80 degrees is some kind of temperature threshold. It could be. We can speculate that for sure. But even in week 8, so after 1 week of being exposed to 3 times a week sauna, 15 minutes, 80 degrees, even in week 8, people were, and it wasn't the same people. It were they were different participants who also said, like, hey, is it time? Can I leave? I'm like, oh, please, like, maybe there's a minute and a half, and I tell them there's only 1 more minute. I did lie a little bit. Yeah. So, full disclosure. Yeah.
So, but that's, maybe I'm sitting in a sauna, which is more than 80 degrees, so that's why I
think, yes. Yeah. That could be a reason.
That could be a reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. You now choose to study for participants with at least one cardiovascular risk factor. Did you think of when you designed your study to choose persons without risk factors, or was that, or do all Finns have a risk factor in this age?
I'll answer your question backwards. I am quite confident not all Finns have a risk factor. That's for sure. But coming back to your main question, the reason why this specific population was selected was because, and this is a philosophically selfish reason. It is to my understanding, majority of the population in the world has at least one risk factor. There are way more people with at least one risk factor, cardiovascular risk factor, than there are apparently healthy people, especially when we get to middle-aged people. So to study apparently healthy people wouldn't be completely representative of the population at large, which is why the choice was made to study people with cardiovascular risk factors, because it represented the society better.
No, that makes sense. Okay, so I was looking into your frame story here and go to page 31. And here you write that guidelines suggest a weaker dose of 150 to 300 minutes of moderate intensity physical activity, 75 to 150 minutes of vigorous intensity physical activity, or an equivalent combination of moderate intensity and vigorous intensity physical activity.
Yes.
When you read Laukkanen's paper, there are a clear cutoff if you go into the sauna 4 to 7 times a week, and you here study 15 or 30 minutes sessions. So if you should, I understand it's too early to give recommendations, but could you speculate in if you should write some recommendations today based on your studies that correspond to those recommendations that I just read?
Yes. So if I understood correctly, you'd like me to speculate if we can provide some kind of sauna-based recommendation that is in line with
exactly
what we have for physical activity. Yes, I would love to speculate. I certainly believe that if we could start by 2 twice a week, 10 minutes each time,
mm-hmm.
10 minutes being the dose, it can be separated by a shower. So it could be 5 minutes and then take a shower and then 5 minutes, or it could be 10 minutes straight, would be a good starting point.
Mm-hmm.
I say that mostly because the research that has been done in this dissertation has used 15 minutes as sort of the ceiling. So if we have seen effects with 15 minutes exposure, perhaps if we use less, we could still get it. Mm. The reason why I say twice a week is also because, for instance, in resistance training, worldwide recommendations, if we don't let Yuha say anything, resistance training is done for a minimum of twice a week. That's the recommendation. So if we follow in that manner, I think it's a good place to start. But again, this is pure speculation. If I could do an additional myth, I really would encourage people to use the sauna twice a day. I would use it in the morning to get, I would recommend people to use it in the morning to kind of get their body ready. Because when we sleep, our temperature drops to facilitate short-term hibernation, which is sleep. When we wake up, our body starts to warm up again. That's why we want to have a cup of coffee or we want to do something to get the body moving. Going into the sauna first thing in the morning might be a very rapid way of getting you there, getting your body woken up, getting the enzymatic activities in your, because all these processes that happen in the body requires a certain temperature, a certain milieu, a certain environment in order to function optimally. So going to the sauna in the morning would have that kind of benefit to get the body ready. But then going to the sauna in the evening also does something else for you. Because when you go to the sauna in the evening, especially before sleep, yes, our body temperature is raised, but then it gets to a point where the physiology of our body wants to compensate for this heat by lowering its temperature. And it lowers your body's temperature way farther than is necessary. You've left the sauna already for 30 minutes, and your body temperature is still dropping. And that is one of the reasons why most people report better sleep quality and more restful sleep if they have used the sauna.
So this was to start with, but you get used to those 10 minutes quickly. So
yes.
Next step, what should that be? In more experienced sauna bathers.
I think from that perspective, we can, okay. Then we need to start making a distinction. And this distinction is very important for this discussion because some of us have access to our own saunas. If we have access to our own saunas, that doesn't only speak about how affluent you are, but it also gives you an additional variable to play with, which is the temperature of the sauna. So that's an important distinction to make. By and large, majority of us go to the public sauna or go to a sauna where we cannot readily alter the temperature. So having made that distinction, people who have their own saunas has options. They could either increase the temperature, they could increase the frequency of usage, or they can increase the duration or length of stay. The people who don't have access to their own sauna, or at least don't have the ability to control for the temperature, would only then be able to control the frequency or the length of exposure. So let's concentrate on that group of people for now. For those individuals who can only control the frequency or the duration, I would almost always suggest increasing the duration first. So for example, like yourself, you will get to the threshold of 15 minutes, and then you can't do anymore. And you know that that's the longest amount of time you can stay. Now that we've reached that threshold, we alter the frequency. So now instead of going 3 times a week, you can go 4 times a week. If we had started with the initial recommendation of two times a week for 10 minutes, now we can tell the user to go 2 times a week, 12 minutes. 2 times a week. Build yourself up to 15 minutes, And then once you're able to stay for a continuous length of time, for 15 minutes, then maybe it's time to start increasing the frequency of visits from 2 to 3 and from 3 to 4. Now, the exact way that is done, I don't really have an answer to, because it almost feels to me a bit like training adaptations. You need some form of periodization almost, because no matter what happens, the thermal impulse that the body is accustomed to will reach a point of stagnation and it will plateau. So you'll have a certain amount of, we should do more research on this, but we'll have a certain amount of sauna fitness. So you'll be able to tolerate being in the sauna. But then there is also a ceiling. And then you need to start doing something else. Maybe now we can, if you're already going to the sauna 5 times a week and you've already been doing it for 15 minutes each time, maybe it's time to start going for 20 minutes. Or let's say 17. Let's be a little bit conservative and say, yeah, add a couple of minutes, and yeah.
Thank you, because I think this is an important discussion, because since we have to standardize the protocols for future research.
Absolutely.
So I think we have to continue this discussion. But thank you for speculating. So I would then turn to page 44 and the table 3 with baseline characteristics.
Yes.
For participants. First, I would like to ask you, how was those participants, how was they identified and informed about the study?
Which study are you referring to?
I was actually thinking about all 4 studies.
Okay.
And if there was some differences between the studies.
Yes. So to answer your question, study 1, the subjects from study 1, actually, the subjects from study 1 and 2 were recruited from a private healthcare clinic, used to be called Dextra, now it's called Bihalyalina. We basically worked with the private clinic, myself and Yari. We put up these notices on their board, and we worked with this very nice lady by the name of Sanna, who is one of our co-authors in one of our papers as well. So she was speaking to the patients whenever they came in, and she identified them. She knew, of course, based on patient records, that, okay, this person has risk factor. And then she would introduce, like, would you like to participate in this sauna study? So the recruitment was largely through that. And also through some of Yari's contacts in the Central Finland Hospital. So we got the pool of participants together, and they performed study 1. Subsequently, for study 2, we asked these same 102 participants if they knew anyone who were like them, who wanted to participate in a sauna-related research. So the 77 participants in study 2 was, shall we say, acquaintances of the 102 initial one that was used in study 1. And then for study 3, now that we have these close to 180 participants in our contact list, mind you, at the time there was no such thing as GDPR. So we had their contact. They were very happy to participate in research studies related to the sauna, very enthusiastic group of people. And so we approached them again, and we asked if they would like to do another experiment, and they were recruited for study number 3. So the 72 participants from study number 3 are picked, or they weren't picked, because some people didn't want to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. They had enough, actually. And so the 72 came from the initial 179.
So they were the same. It could be the same. They were the same.
Yes, it could have been the same.
Yeah.
But there were also new participants that were recruited as well.
Those 77, they were new.
Yes.
Yeah. Those in the third study, they were recruited from the study 1 and 2.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is right. And then for study four, thanks to the good work of my co-author, Iris. Is she in the room today? Okay, well, Iris, she was a master's student at the time, and then now she's a PhD student herself. She helped out with the recruitment of participants in several local companies. So she sent emails. I think I would also have to thank Juha for that, because he oversaw the whole process. So he worked with this student to help us with the recruitment process. So we got them from various companies, Valmet and nearby Finnish local companies, via email, and also some gyms. Yeah. So at the time, some of the students that helped with the project were working part-time in some local gyms, and so they helped to spread the word in the gym to ask if anybody knows someone who wants to study. Obviously, if you recruit from the gym, then you'll have people who already exercise regularly, which is not what we're looking for at least for the fourth study. So that's why when we started with 60 people, but then we had, after going through the selection criteria, we ended up with 48.
So one strength, I think, with this study is that there are more participants compared to if you in other studies. Usually they are smaller, 10, 15. And was it hard to recruit? Did they, were there many that was asked that said no?
For the fourth study?
I mean, for all studies, actually. Because it's impressive that you could engage that many.
We actually had, if I'm being honest, we actually had more.
Okay.
But some of the data was incomplete. So we didn't want to publish data that was not, we had missing data, essentially. So it was not 102. I believe we had about 110 people come in for the first study. Then when we narrowed it down and we looked at the people were enthusiastic.
Yeah.
And then some people didn't have any risk factor. They just came. Which is fine. Everybody enjoys the sauna, you know, especially your own private sauna. You know, you come in and we're not doing any kind of invasive measures. So they enjoyed it. But we had to leave some of that data out. So there were not, within the study itself, once they promised that they were going to participate, they all showed up, yeah. Which is, it for the average person, it almost comes as no surprise. Oh, Finland, sauna research, of course they're going to show up. But still, it's surprising that we didn't have anyone who canceled on us last minute. And if there were people who couldn't show up, because this was performed not over a single day, 102 participants, we spread them over a few weeks. And some people who had a scheduled appointment didn't show up, very apologetic, sent us emails and said, could I come on another day? And of course we accommodated them. So in terms of on the ground, what is happening, like for example from Sanna's position when she was talking to the prospective participants, I don't know what that rejection rate was, so whether, you know, more people agreed than not, that I'm not sure. But for the people that showed up for the study, I would say they're angels.
Yeah, because they have to. Am I right that in three of the studies they were traveling down to the Harvia?
Yes, they were traveling down to Muurame, where Harvia built as a lab,
which
we're very thankful for. And and Timo was there overseeing and helping us with a lot of the preparations. Yeah.
And majority were in their working age, so.
Yes.
Were they paid or how did you?
So to my understanding that research in Finland isn't paid. As a participant in research in Finland, you don't get paid. You can be given gifts in kind, but they have to be taxed. So that leaves us in a very tricky situation where the cost of giving remuneration to the participants is not only a bit high, but also somewhat tricky. What we did to circumvent that, for the first three studies at least, is we, out of our own pocket, out of our own pocket, we presented a spread of food for the participants after they were done with the intervention. So we came in the morning, early in the morning. Imo was always very, very punctual in getting one of his staff to open the facility for us at 8:30. So we go in there at 8:30. The first participant will show up at 9:15. And for 8:30, Yari's car will be filled with food. And you name it, sparkling water, non-alcoholic wine, fruits. We were carry baskets of food, basically. Croissants, everything, like cookies, you know. And we had an initial list of things that we thought they would like, and we put it there, and they ate it, of course. But then some of the participants started giving suggestions. Maybe you should put a monkey. Or and yeah, maybe it'd be nice if you put, you know, some other pastry there as well. And so we did take that feedback into account because we knew we were going to conduct more studies, and we needed to ask these people to sort of assist us in recruiting more participants. So we always adhere to their requests. We always say, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's buy this. Yeah, okay, you want a donut? Let's buy the donut. So
what was most successful in that?
In that research?
Donut.
I think the most successful is that we did not leave the research with an empty bank account.
Yeah. So there are three limitations, I think.
Yeah,
and you can comment on those. First, the water on the stones were not regulated.
No.
And neither was the drinking.
Neither was the drinking.
But it was a limit on 500 milliliters, if I'm reading this right.
There was no limit.
No limit. So
they could drink however much they wanted.
Okay.
Yes.
And the third thing was the shower. Temperature, it was, if I am right, 2 minutes, but the temperature was not controlled, or even if they went into the shower. So can you comment on those three? Do you think that has influenced the result in any way?
Yes, you're right, and thanks for pointing that out. They do influence the results. I think when we start talking about consumption of water, we know that the water will not be replenished in the interstitial and in the system quickly enough anyway. So they can be in the sauna, they can feel the thirst, but if they drink the water, it doesn't actually get to the cells in that short of a period of time. The research that I've read so far has shown that it takes about an hour and a half to two hours. So that is why most athletes who do endurance events usually go dehydrated. They would drink a lot of water, hour and a half, 2 hours prior, so that they would have that water to lose, and they wouldn't be dehydrated in the end. That loss of fluid could then affect blood plasma volume levels, which wasn't one of the variables we studied, because we understood that limitation in a sense. We did want the control for the amount of water to drink. But that was shot down by many participants. So this comes back to one of your earlier questions. There were some participants who were not very agreeable that the water was to a certain amount. And so we had to bend, essentially, in order to keep the more participants in the study. So with regards to water consumption, at least, that was one of the limitations. With regards to the shower, definitely a limitation. It wasn't controlled for very tightly, which is why later on it was addressed in the fourth study. where they went for sauna 15 minutes. And you want to take a shower, take it later. We're not going to let you. No. That's one of the considerations. So the problems that we face, these limitations that we face from the initial three studies, and they were commented, quite rightly so, by the reviewers of the article. They pointed out the temperature of the shower definitely will have an effect, mm-hmm. as well as the length. As we have seen, there is a intervention or a method these days called contrast therapy, where people will get subject themselves to the heat and then immediately yeah. do a cold plunge and then back again to the heat and then cold plunge, and they do these in a few sets, if you will. And that has been studied, not extensively, but to a certain degree we have seen that it can affect what happens in the end. When we planned the first study and the second study, we knew that it was almost going to be impossible, because we tried ourselves. I always say this, in the name of science, we went ourselves, me and Yari, as pilots into the sauna, coming out, not taking a shower, just being in the ambient temperature for a minute or two, and then going back in. We felt like it was okay, but not the participants. So they wanted a shower.
Yeah,
yeah, they wanted a shower. We did a small pilot of about 20 people with the first two experiments. And yeah, they wanted a shower. Could we have done it without the shower? Yes, we absolutely could have, because these Finnish participants are the most amazing that I've ever done research on. They are so compliant that if we had pushed, they would have said, ah, okay. Mind you, they would still talk behind your back after that. They'll complain about you. But that's okay. They would still have followed through the protocol. But then that would not have been the most accurate reflection of how sauna is used in a typical fashion. Because I don't really know anyone who goes to the sauna and then doesn't take a shower. So the shower is there. And maybe it is up to these researchers who are doing research in thermoregulation and also cold exposure to kind of understand if the temperature and length of a cold shower would affect the outcomes of sauna bathing as an intervention. Maybe that's something we need to look into. Yeah, I know it's very specific. It's almost like trying to separate a piece of paper from itself, but maybe that's what we need to do.
But did I get it right that you didn't track the participants if they were showering and the temperature?
No, we did. Well, we didn't watch them shower. that would be wrong. But we gave them the option to take a shower, but we did not monitor if, okay, this participant had a shower, this participant didn't go for a shower. Yeah. Usually, they left the sauna, but not all of them took the shower. Yeah. Because they wanted to come out and take a breather.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then go back in. So they did leave the sauna, but not all of them took the shower.
Yeah, thank you. And on page 55, table 4, there are many parameters down there. And for us not being in this atrial compliance and hemodynamic business in our daily work,
yeah,
would you like to explain in a way that so we that understand how what those parameters actually stands for?
Right. So there is left ventricular ejection time, which is a function of the heart, just like diastolic time. It is more of a derivative of heart rate. So if you have increased heart rate, left ventricular ejection time and diastolic time will lower. So we can see, even though we did not get very significant pre to post 30 changes in heart rate that were significant changes pre to post based on table 4. And so that is reflected also by the reduction of left ventricular ejection time and diastolic time, so the time taken for the blood. Now, with regards to pulse wave velocity, I came prepared. So some of you might have been subjected to this already. Some of you have not. Some of you have seen this in action on almost like a daily basis. Some of you have not. I'm going to pass this equipment around so that everybody gets a touch of it.
So Eric, this is the pulse pen.
This is the pulse pen. This is the tonometer, and this is where all these parameters are captured.
So this was your best friend?
So this was my only friend. Yeah. And if we are in a room full of sports people, right? If you can find your carotid artery and palpate it for a second, your own, you should be able to feel a pulse. It doesn't matter if it's left or right, huh? You should be able to feel quite a strong pulse, right? Now, this is what's happening. So the equipment that's being passed around at the moment is labeled A. So I stick that on someone's neck, and then the device, through applanation tonometry, measures the blood that is going through. And it also detects the reflected wave. So we assume that the thick area of this particular artery is the artery itself, and then it branches off into the arterioles, which are narrower. And because they're narrower, there's more pressure, because there's more resistance. From that resistance, the wave is reflected backward. The same device that is being handed around now will pick that up as well, reflect it in the software on the laptop, and that's where you'll see the pulse wave that you see on that figure in between the artery and the reflected wave at the bottom.
So this was taken at the carotids, but not in the femoral?
Both. So careful if you're touching that.
In what you started out here and then?
Yeah, so it's reliant on two sites, the carotid and the femoral, because in doing so, we can then estimate central aortic stiffness. The device and the software does allow us to also determine peripheral stiffness of the vasculature. So if we had measured, let's say, the brachial artery and somewhere here, then we would know the stiffness of the vasculature in this segment. Similarly, we can also measure from the carotid to here, and then we would know this segment, this entire, including the shoulder. You could also measure the tibialis and get, or even the pedialis vein, and estimate the vascular stiffness of one single extremity. Yeah, that is also possible with this device. We haven't done that. Yeah.
So how long time does it take to measure the carotids?
it's a good question. The first 6 months of me using this device was exactly like how I was giving the lecture. A lot of sweat, a lot of nervousness, and not very good measurements. So in a single site, for one participant, it took me about 10 minutes. Because from the palpating to finding the right way to hold the pen, even though we were trained by the Italians, who are the manufacturers of this product, there's a specific way of applying pressure on the artery so that the wave is reflected and you see it on the software. 6 months later, I was still bad at it, but now it took only 5 minutes per site. Fast forward 7 years later. I think my fellow colleagues who have seen me do this can attest that I could probably complete the measurement, the entire measurement, both sides in 7 minutes. Yeah. Not that I'm boasting. But it is hard to learn. It is difficult. It is not difficult to train someone to do it. But to learn how to do it, because I've tried to teach some bachelor's degree students and master's degree students so that it frees up some of my time, so that they can do the measurement and I can do something else. But it hasn't been very easy for most people to pick it up. The patient or the participant is required to be in a certain position, lying down, supine. The way you hold the pen in your finger has to be in a very specific way. So you gotta hold it this way, flat, and your fingers should be touching the skin of the participant. Not only that, you need to remain stable in that position for 10 cardiac cycles. So there's an ECG unit that's attached at the same time, and the foot of the wave corresponds to the PQRS complex of the cardiac cycle. That's how the software determines pulse wave velocity, essentially. So you have to get stable measurements with your hand on the participant, with your eye on the software, and judging the cycles as it goes through, that you've captured a signal that is of sufficient quality that you can then save. Take the pen away, check, and ensure that, okay, in all the projects that I've used this equipment with thus far, the minimum, there's a quality index in the software, so they'll tell you how good your data was, the data that you captured. And we always strive for at least 90%. Sometimes when I get a very good sample, let's call it that, a very good human being, I would try and get 98 or 99%, because when you can palpate such a nice pulse and you can feel it, you just want to get the best data possible. And then there are times where people with higher levels of subcutaneous fat or higher BMI or softer arteries, and it's so tricky to get the measurement, you really just want to be done with very quickly. Yeah. I have to admit. So, yeah.
But did you do all this by yourself, or did you teach anyone to help you?
No. So all the measurements in this study, in the entire dissertation, were taken by myself, me alone. Now, there were measurements that were taken, for example, body position, taken with the DEXA, that was performed by other operators. The bachelor students that helped me in the project came in the morning, 6 a.m., got the machine ready, waiting for our participants to arrive. My dearest lab technicians were there to grind with me in the morning at 6:30, 7 a.m., following my schedule to help me to collect the blood, centrifuge them, make sure that they're stored at minus 80 degrees Celsius. So there were measurements that were done by me, but I can only do so much, and I have them to thank for all the other indices that we have.
So it's a weakness that is so hard. You have to learn and do this, and it should be better if it was easier to do this.
There is an easier way to do it, but the trade-off is always validity. We have devices in the market that are reliable, but might not be valid because of the technology that they choose to use. Then we have devices that are reliable and valid, such as the pulse pen, very difficult to master or use. And I'm sure that applies for most of the technology that we use in our labs in science. It could be a very easy to use piece of equipment. For example, if we were to measure body composition, we could use the in-body. It's very simple. You just stand and the operator clicks a few buttons. But we know that it's not the fidelity and accuracy of the data is not as good as doing a DEXA scan. But the DEXA scan requires you to prepare the participant, get them lying down in the right position, and then knowing how to operate that particular piece of equipment also takes some expertise in monitoring the situation as well at the same time. So I think as we get better with understanding how the human body functions, we will find better ways, invent better products to make this easier, I am sure. Yeah. But as of yesterday, when I checked, ablation tonometry, not this particular product, but the technology used, which is ablation tonometry, for the measurement of vascular stiffness, is still the gold standard. So, depends how you like to eat your cake.
So, thank you. Before moving to the first paper, I'm a little bit curious because when reading Laukkanen's group's paper on the effect of chronic diseases, there's one disease that was not influenced by frequent sunbathing. Can you recall what that was? Was affecting cardiovascular, dementia, stroke, hypertonia, thromboembolism, pulmonary disease, but there were one disease that. Cancer. You should say cancer.
I just.
No, but I'm wondering why didn't he find or they find a correlation between frequent sunbathing and decreased risk of cancer?
I have actually read some research in that area where how we came up with radiotherapy as a form of treatment for cancer was actually, not entirely due to, but there was in 2000, year 2000, in the late 90s, some interest in using heat to deal with cancer cells and to deal with let's say, malignant cells. But they found that it did not make much of a difference. The heat did not. In fact, what they found was that when we suffer from a certain kind of disease, how it started was this group of medical doctors postulated that the reason why we have fever or an increase in temperature to fight off an infection, being that heat is the best way to kill off the bacteria and the virus. So the body's own defensive mechanism kicks in to try and eliminate this parasite in the body. So that's where they started saying, if that's what the body is already doing on its own, trying to increase its temperature to protect itself, then if we introduce endogenous heat, then it should work the same way. But then it did not. So then it stopped. The research in that to that direction then stopped. And I think to some degree, there's a difficulty for us to say we want the, risk of cancer is different from the actual cancer itself.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm talking more now about the cancer itself. Now, it's a cell like any other. So it requires certain conditions to be, to survive, let's say. And so if we were the one to try and kill them off, like what they do in chemotherapy, many of your other cells start dying as well. So we're left with using heat that is so high that may cause you to denature, that will cause your proteins to break down. And that's not necessarily something that we want to do to ourselves. So in terms of addressing cancer, tricky, very tricky, just because of that. The risk of cancer. I don't want to sound like I'm blaming anybody, but ourselves, the community, the scientific community, but we still don't have a good enough grasp and understanding of cancer and because of that, the spillover effects is we don't understand the risk of cancer all too well. We understand it better than we did 50 years ago, but I still don't think we understand it that because as Thomas Kuhn said, he could only be sure that with the same stimuli, it could create a different sensation to somebody else. So you could apply, you could do the same thing, but then the results could be different. So every human being is sort of different. And so with cancer, it's unique to the organism itself. Knock on wood, if I were to have a cancer, and my cancer would be different from, for example, my father's cancer. Maybe we both have lung cancer, but my lung cancer may be a different tumor type, different cell type than his. So then how do we prevent? Do you follow where I'm coming from?
Yeah,
so we still need to gather more information, and then the prevention, I guess, will sort itself out, so to say.
Yeah, because different lifestyle factors can actually reduce the risk of cancer.
Yes.
And I was thinking, cancer cells doesn't like heat. You increase the blood flow to the cancer. You stimulate the immune response. You reduce the inflammatory status. And there are many different ways that I think that could be added, because now we know that physical activity is good in cancer patients, also to prevent relapses. So maybe it could be worthwhile looking into, I think.
Yes, but it's worthwhile looking into if I follow my heart. If I follow my head and my understanding of exercise physiology, and I'm going to be very biased because I like exercise physiology a lot. There is something about exercise with the cascade of processes that happen unique to exercise that is not exactly the same as when we do sauna bathing. Not only is there a mechanical transduction of force by the muscles, which is what starts a lot of this movement in the satellite cells, protein synthesis and all that. The work done is very different. And the benefits are such that the inner workings can only be, it's one of the reasons why, I'm gonna die on this hill, okay? There's a reason why I hope that I will never see an exercise pill in my existence, in my lifetime. If it comes later, great for humanity. But there is something about being physically engaged. Now, can we do physical activity, soft physical activity, like yoga or a little bit of a basic exercise in the sauna? Sure. And I think that's something that we should look at. If physical activity can already reduce cancer risk, why not introduce low-level physical activity in the sauna, particularly for people who have lowered exercise capacity? I think that's a great area to look into. Yeah. But I would never take exercise away from anything. Yeah.
Okay, so I will now look into paper one and four, starting with paper one.
Yeah. Sauna exposure leads to improved arterial compliance, findings from a non-randomized experimental study. Is this right, that arterial stiffness is a risk factor for CVD, and resting blood pressure is a surrogate measure to arterial stiffness?
That is correct.
That is correct. Okay. So let's start with looking into table 2, page 134. And so if we look at all parameters here, were significant pre-post, but only LVAT pre-post 30. How should this be interpreted? It is enough to tell that there are less stiff arterioles after 30 minutes.
That is not completely correct. So, and that is now with hindsight. So, at the time of the publishing of this paper, we were very excited about the fact that, yes, we found this. But this is more a reflection of functional changes. And with the fourth study, as we have shown, there were no changes. And those are more structural,
yeah,
which we want, or which is more sought after, at least. So, based on table two, we could confidently say that there are some immediate changes to vascular stiffness, but these do not these simply do not last for a very long time.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're more transient than we initially thought.
Okay.
Yeah. But they are still, nonetheless, beneficial, transient, acute changes.
Okay, because looking at table 3, this is central hemodynamic variables. Here only MAP pre-post and PP pre-post 30 were significant. If you compare with the results in table 2, were you surprised, or is this in line with what you just said?
Based on the literature, and I think back to the time when I first done that, when I first done the study, it does seem that this is a somewhat expected finding, not from table two, not the arterial stiffness outcomes, because we simply did not know, we did not have information at the time, so it's quite exploratory in that sense. But for the results on table three, because of all the work that has been done by previous Finnish authors, Lev Palotto, we can have Vuori, some of the and even I always forget her name, but this lady from the Tampere, from the UKK Institute, the last name is Urho, Harimuna, yeah, Sharon and Dave done the work on a lot of the blood pressure related indices. So it was us kind of piggybacking on their work, so extending their findings. In that manner, the hemodynamic variables were somewhat expected. Yeah, we were hoping, in a way, although that's not right to do as a scientist, but we were hoping that we'd see something there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, because looking at table 4 then, here we can see that systolic and diastolic blood pressure were significant pre-post. But when you look 30 minutes after, only systolic, why did not the diastolic pressures deal?
I think there might have to do with something related to the afterload, but that's, again, high speculation on our part, because we didn't do echography or cardiac ultrasound in order to find out about this. But then it's quite in line with study number 4, because with study number 4, I know I'm moving too far forward, but as it relates to this, because this is acute in nature, whereas study four was more of a interventional study, we didn't find changes to diastolic blood pressure either, long term. So I almost feel like it is a reflection of what we found from this first study, that these were the changes, and somehow these long-term changes happened with the use of sauna as well. With regards specifically to the diastolic blood pressure, I could only speculate that based on, if we go back to table two and we look at the diastolic time, then it corresponds very well to the same changes that we see in diastolic time. So it could be related to that, which would be, again, cardiac afterload.
So this pulse plan is an obstacle. Could, to simplify, may systolic blood pressure, diastolic blood pressure, and heart rate only be enough surrogate for measure arterial stiffness with your experience from this study?
I would say no, because then the picture is incomplete. I think what we try to do is to, in the process of not only elimination of finding what the plausible causes may be or mechanisms, we also want to understand what is contributing to these changes. So if it was only blood pressure and heart rate, then the picture or the story is rather vague. So if it's supported by other variables, I think we can be more conclusive with our speculations and the things that we can say. But I certainly do not think that just with these three variables it is sufficient. From a clinical perspective, possibly. Because in research, we aim to try and provide as much information as we can. But clinicians, these are the things that clinicians rely on primarily. And that should not be, no credit should be taken away from that. It is useful. And in fact, the pulse pen was marketed by the Italians as a piece of equipment that can be used by the clinicians because of how, and I quote, easy the measurement can be taken. So, yes, it was meant to assist because we didn't go very deeply into the inner workings of the device, but it doesn't function standalone. The pulse pen requires blood pressure to be taken. Yeah. Otherwise, you will not get the variables, or shall I say, they will not be able to. The software doesn't compute the variables.
So, did I get the conclusion of this study right, that it is improved arterial compliance and decreased blood pressure seen in this study?
That is correct.
Yeah. And I like to simplify, so maybe in the future, it's very nice design, and now you know that the arterial stiffness story, but since we know this now, I would say that blood pressure and heart rate might be sufficient in future studies. But anyway, I like to simplify and standardize.
That's correct. And I understand your point too.
Good. So or if you should design this in another way today, is there any corrections or other design you should use?
For study number one?
Yeah.
Yes, I would.
Or tell me.
I'm going to be very ambitious, because this is like my fairy tale, right? I would have a group that does this, so 15 minutes, shower, 15 minutes. I'll have another group that does 10 minutes, shower, 10 minutes, so for 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. So basically 10, shower, 10, shower, 10.
Yeah.
And then I would have a 5 minute. So then but with matched duration. So basically the exposure to heat would have been the same, right, for 30 minutes. But the way they're being exposed to the heat is different. Because we know from a lot of, not just anecdotal evidence, but also a bit of published evidence that typically users of the sauna go into the sauna for between 5 to 6 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll take a shower,
yeah.
and then they'll go back in.
Mm-hmm.
If we start doing research that is asking people to be there for 15 minutes, it may not truly reflect what is being done in the society. So at the time, again, I was a bit of a rookie, so I did not understand that. And so we did not design the study that way. But if I was given the opportunity to do that again, I would definitely have that. Because then we would be able to tell if one way of using the sauna was better than the other. And then we can kind of, the sauna companies like Harvia can benefit from that information better, consumer level, sort of like the public who are consuming this information, who are looking, can then actually see, oh, and for instance, it might not make any sense to do 15 minutes and then shower and then 15 minutes. It might make more sense, or the changes might be more profound if you did the way people are doing typically, which is 5, take a break, 5, take a break, and do this for, like, repeated over 6 times. For the same 30 minutes, just a different way of being exposed to the load. Yeah. I would have done that.
Because now we know what a Finnish sauna is, but do we know how Finns usually bathe sauna? You said 5, 5. I don't think that is right, because that's the way I do it, actually. But I'm not the, you know, have you asked the Finnish people how they do?
Yeah, I've asked, I've seen, and I have secretly collected data as well.
Oh, good.
Yeah. The average amount of time, I would say, is between, based on my sneaky measurements, 7 to 10.
Okay.
Yeah. The literature says 5 to 6.
Uh-huh.
But I would say 5 to 6 is probably, it's not fair to say this, but I'll say it anyway. It's probably with a lot of alcohol.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe 5 to 6, you know, you drink a bit of alcohol, you got a bit intoxicated, and then you want to go out and take a dip in the lake. But if you're not intoxicated and you're only drinking water, then most of the time what I have observed is between 7 to 10 minutes.
Yeah. And how many sessions?
Oh, that really, really depends. Again, no anecdotal. It's completely all anecdotal.
You didn't ask this.
I would say, my computer is a bit slow today. 4 or 5. 4 or 5 repeats. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. 5, if you're in good company, that's a major factor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, otherwise 4. But yeah, 4 or 5. Yeah. And then this does not include, so sometimes when I do my observations and I collect little notes about how people are using their how people use the sauna, there are often times when they are taking a break for far too long, in my opinion. So they'll exit the sauna after 10 minutes, and they will be taking a break, alcohol or not, for maybe 20 minutes. Yeah. So then they're resting longer than they're being exposed to the heat, which then changes the dynamic of the heat load again. So I'm not taking those into consideration. These 4 or 5 exposures are taking into consideration that they leave the sauna, maybe go for a quick shower or a dip in the lake, and then quite quickly they're back in the sauna again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, generally about 4 rounds. 4 rounds. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I think we jump to paper 2: acute effects of exercise and sauna as screening intervention on arterial compliance. First, looking at table one. First, when I read this and looked at cardiovascular risk classification, there are almost 70% here that have high cholesterol values. I was a little bit surprised, but then I looked into how it looks in Sweden, and actually it's almost the same. It's a little bit higher actually in the studies that have been performed, around 80% maybe. But there is a difference in LDL between male and female. So male had higher, around 60, and females around 50 in this piece. Also, obesity, one third of those were obese.
Yep.
How do you think about this?
They shouldn't be. But, jokes aside, I do feel, and I don't have the statistics for Asia or for Australia on hand right now, but I do feel it is a function of the weather. We're animals, after all. We need to store fat in order to hibernate for winter. So this could very well, the similarities between Sweden and Finland could very well be due to that, evolutionary reasons. I'm not a biologist, so I can't speak further to that, but that is my smartest guess. The obesity that we see in this particular table is not really an accurate reflection of uvascular, because a third, that means every third person you see is obese, but clearly in this room, I don't see any. But if we went outside, even if we went to the lobby, it's not one out of three. But then this is very specific to central Finland, because in Jyväskylä, this is one of the fittest Finnish cities. However, this does reflect very well, probably, if you go to the capital in Helsinki. So I'm actually quite satisfied with how the dispersion of the cardiovascular risk factors were after we've collected it, because it is a very accurate slice of Finland, in spite of the fact that this study was performed in Jyväskylä, which is skewed toward more healthy people, more health conscious people, but yet we still had this dispersion.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Really obesity, but it is a major threat for the human being. I mean, with the obesity among children.
Oh yes.
And we can also, I mean, also looking into Asia now, it's a bomb.
To a large degree, I do feel that it has to do with quality of life. At least in Western countries. As we get more affluent, as we increase our spending power, as we increase our level of enjoyment of creature comforts, we start to become complacent a little bit. We start moving less. Aging aside, you can make life very comfortable. And as life starts getting comfortable, you start not doing the things that are hard anymore. And if you exercise, it's not easy. It comes easy to people who are already exercising. But if we shift our perspective to people who are not currently exercising, and we tell them to exercise, it's a hard task. Not just the motivation, but where do we start? How do we start? And so it is far easier to maintain status quo, and as a result, become obese. You may not be obese to begin with. To your point about childhood obesity, that is a major problem. many times across the different continents that I've lived and worked in, I have observed this. You may not see it the same way as I do, but I'm going to put it out there. There's a tendency for obese parents to have obese children. I'm not trying to make anybody sound bad, but that is just my observation. And it happens almost irrespective of which part of the world you're in. It can happen in Australia. You very rarely find an obese kid with fit parents. Or let's not even say fit, but looks to be within the BMI range, right? So is it genetics? I don't know. Is it lifestyle? Very much so. And it has such a bearing on the society as we move forward that we need to try and get these people to be more physically active, not just for the sake of vanity or for the sake of health. It's very difficult to sell health to someone who hasn't been sick. So an obese person may not feel sick. They may have difficulty doing things because of their obesity, but they don't usually feel like they have a problem. Yes, I am fat, so what? And so to get those people to buy into, hey, you're gonna be able to walk further, or you're gonna be able to climb the steps. You don't have to take the elevator anymore. Why? They would. I've often been told, like, I'm completely happy with taking the elevator. Okay, sure, I'll walk the stairs. But to get them to buy into, we're as a society, we've become so myopic that we don't look beyond and think that, okay, if I exercise now, my quality of life in future would be greatly increased. And so I'm going to do what I can now to ensure that when I get there at some stage, because we all will, that is kind of a good quality of life that I'm living. But we don't do that these days. We think about, wow, that's a nice piece of cake in front of me. Let's do it. Yeah. So that is the instant gratification and kind of being the human weakness versus trying to sell a future that they can't really picture. That's why we have these obesity problems.
But can we agree upon that a lot of fight sports, they use the sauna for reduced weight, but it's due to loss of fluid?
Yes.
And can we agree upon that you cannot use sauna for weight reduction?
Ooh. Like, rather than weight reduction.
Exactly.
The data that I found doesn't seem to suggest that.
Tell me.
Yeah. So the data that we found shows reduction in cholesterol, but not fat per se.
No.
So the body composition changes. So reduction of BMI essentially becomes the question. Is only reflected in the exercise intervention. So when we put sauna into the equation, it doesn't seem like, in terms of like long-term weight loss, let's say, permanent weight loss, it doesn't seem like it exerts that much of an influence. Could there be, if we had increased the intervention to 10 weeks, or 12, or possibly 16, I don't rule it out, but I don't have the evidence to back up that postulation. But having said that, will there be a significant weight loss as such that it can bring you from one category of BMI into the other? I highly doubt. Yeah. If that is the question, then Yeah, no.
So I think this is interesting, and this has to be studied further, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, another question here in table one. I couldn't find the age range or the frequency of or the gender, the number of different males and females.
Do you
recall?
You may be right. Yes, I believe.
Because in the fourth study there were a majority of females, but
I believe it was close to even distribution.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But slightly favoring the men,
yeah,
still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Figure one, here you show that there was a greater effect on post 30 when exercising was combined with sauna.
Yes.
Compared with sauna alone. Why is that?
Well, I'm fairly certain that there is an interaction.
Mm-hmm.
There is an interaction in the sense that there's an additional cardiovascular load on the human body post-exercise and introducing the sauna to it. Now, when we exercise, there's a reduction, there's an increase in insulin sensitivity, and there's a reduction in various other outcome parameters, also an increase in androgenic factors. So this creates kind of like an optimum environment for some other intervention to interact with, which is why one of the things that we do a lot in the faculty is we do combined exercise. We do aerobic exercise and then we do strength exercise. So we do strength exercise followed by aerobic exercise, because different types of training or training itself, post-training, there's always a window. And in that window, it's so important to do according to your goal, what you're trying to achieve. For some people, it might, in that post-exercise window, you might want to supplement. You might want to have a protein shake. You might want to eat carbs, depending on your goal, again. But it is no less still an opportunity for something else to be injected, to interact with it. So I personally feel that there always will be. You can do, I haven't studied it, but post-exercise, if you go to extreme cold exposure, we might see something similar to this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because post-exercise, if we standardize for the exercise, so 150 minutes according to the exercise recommendations, the effects that your body goes through or has or show exhibits is still the same. So then it depends on the interaction in the subsequent part, the conjunctive intervention. What does that do? So that comes back to why we designed the dissertation is the way it is, because in the first one we found that sauna was able to do certain things, and then now we want to see if sauna can interact effectively with exercise and not just be on its own, because we know for a fact that people like to go to the sauna after exercise, but the purpose that they used it for was for recovery mostly, and then nobody really looked at if there could be some additive effect. So that's where study two comes in. We wanted to, we didn't know, we, to be fairly honest, we didn't know if this was going to be what we were going to see. But I'm glad it turned out.
Yeah. You mentioned insulin sensitivity, and I mean, physical activity is for sure good, but have you looked into, because there are, you know, some studies out there that you know, tells us that it might be so that heat therapy can reduce insulin resistance. What is your, have you looked into this?
Unfortunately, I have not. I've seen the papers that mention it,
yeah,
briefly on the headlines. I think it's the study that was done in Oregon, I believe, like the polycystic ovary syndrome women. They were using heat therapy as they were using hot water immersion
as the form feed therapy, and they showed that. I remember reading about them, but there hasn't been that many studies showing that, and generally, we're still at a point where it's very difficult to look at the study population and compare them, because mostly they're still being done on the clinical population, or at least the subclinical. So I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah. Interesting feed. You write here that this study was exploratory, based on the novel nature of the topic, and more advanced study designs will be needed in the future.
That's correct.
How should you design a more
advanced study? Oh, again, you're giving me the keys to the kingdom. Okay. I would say a 30-minute cycling exercise with a break in between. So, because the way we designed it was 15 minutes,
yeah.
A break, and then 15 minutes. This study too. I would have a comparative group where they did 15 minutes exercise, took the same break, and then instead of going into the sauna, did another 15 minutes exercise. Then we would be able to have that exercise only, cycling exercise only data, to compare with this exercise and sauna data, and then we can also compare that to the first study, which was a sauna only data. So then we would have three, in essentially then paper three would look completely different. It would be 30 minutes of exercise with a break in between for 15 minutes. One which is 15 minutes of exercise, and then people go to the sauna, and then another which is like sauna, break, sauna again. Yeah. That was one of the, I would have to admit, one of the weaknesses that it was our oversight that we didn't look at it that way, or maybe we didn't have time. I certainly did not have a lot of time to look at the study design that way, because in the submission of not just this article, but article number 3 as well, the criticism that were coming from the reviewer was that you could have done this,
yeah,
which is an exercise-only intervention, then you'd see if really the sauna added these things.
Yeah.
But now you can't, and I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's jump to study 3. All
right.
So standalone sauna versus exercise followed by sauna on cardiovascular function in non-naive sauna users, the comparison of the effect. So, what is, I'm just now reading table 1, what is a non-naive sauna user?
Yes, that's a good question. I should find out who the who the article reviewer was and have him sit down here, him or her. We did not want to include that in the title of the article, but one reviewer of this article insisted that we do, because his or her point was that you cannot generalize this, because people in Finland go to sauna way more often than any other population, so they are non-naive. Naive being you've never gone to the sauna before, or you very rarely go to the sauna. So the reviewer insisted that no, you have to put this in the title. And I yielded. I said, okay, sure. Yeah.
Because if you summarize in this sauna habits in the text here, so 79% use the sauna once a week or more.
Yes.
So that's your definition.
Yes. Well, no, the definition is that I don't remember very clearly, but I do remember this same reviewer, because there were 3 reviewers for this paper, and one of them had the most to say about this. We wanted to quantify it somehow by saying that, okay, there were some that were not and some that were, but his or her point of contention was like,
these people, it's part of a culture for Finnish people. They might have been sauna bathing since they were 10. And then maybe they stopped sauna bathing 5 months before you, or basically they were trying to say like, the Finnish people grew up using the sauna. So you cannot say that they are naive, that they've never done the sauna in their life, or they're only a very habitual user. They are frequent users. You don't know the history of their sauna usage. So as a result of that, he or she drove the point that it cannot be generalized. You have to state it explicitly that these people are non-naive. So the sauna habits we added so that we can let the reader know what our population was.
Oh, jumping back one page here to figure one. The design of this study, so I understand, it was 72 people.
Yes.
How were they? What were they like? 36 that started with 15 minutes of sauna and 36. Or how did you organize it?
So we organized it in this way, where we had our own system of alternating. So the bike was already there, and this was in RPS premises, yeah. And so the bike was already there. It's a stationary bike, and we alternate. The first person who comes will use the sauna only. The second person on that day who comes will do exercise and sauna, and so forth. But the following day, we switch the order. The first person who came would do exercise plus sauna first. Because we didn't want the participants to tell their friends, like, hey, if you came second, you would do this. And, yeah. So we had to. It wasn't the most strict randomization, but we had an order of sorts. Yes.
Okay, thanks. First, then jumping to table two here. Here, if we look at the sauna group and compare with the exercise and sauna and look into the diastolic blood pressure and also MAP. So it seems for me that sauna was more effective.
Yes, you are right. Pre-post, the effects of the sauna intervention were more profound. Yeah, they were larger and they were more significant. So, and of course, the MAP, based on the software, was calculated as a function of systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure. So, it wasn't a surprise to see mean arterial pressure, MAP, change the way that it did, just purely based on systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure, particularly diastolic blood pressure. But this was not retained.
No. So if you look at table three now, here we can see that systolic, diastolic, and AMP was actually more effectively reduced in the exercise sauna.
Yes, in the exercise and sauna. Yes. Yes.
In this post 30 minutes comparison.
Yes. Yeah. So in that recovery period, they were still, so we could say that these reductions were still sustained,
mm-hmm.
yeah, which isn't a bad thing.
No.
Yeah.
So, and I think I read somewhere in this paper that the gold standard of assessing arterial stiffness is the pulse wave velocity. Is that right?
That is correct.
So wouldn't you think that there should be a difference in this study?
It's unfortunate that there wasn't a difference.
Yeah.
I was looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't there. And I think there might have been that there might have been
don't want to say, maybe the interactions are a little bit different when you put exercise together with sauna.
Yeah.
There was, and even in some very, very, for even for the pulse rate velocity of the sauna in this particular study, we did not see the changes that we saw in the first study. I am not entirely sure why that is the case, because I was the same, it was the same operator, and we used the same protocol.
And age, sex, CPD risk factors, didn't?
Yes. No. That was all accounted for and controlled, and still, yeah. So, I guess we can't really say that arterial stiffness or short-term changes in arterial stiffness is influenced that much by sauna bathing. Yeah.
So, and I also understood that you changed the protocol when it comes to avoid knee in the first study compared with this one.
Yes.
So, because in the first study, I think it was you should avoid caffeine and smoking, let's say, 3 hours before.
That's correct.
And in this one, 2 hours for eating, 12 for caffeine, and then 24 for alcohol. So, why did you change?
Yeah, that's a good question. We change it, and if I'm being frank, because there was a miscommunication between myself and Yari.
Okay.
We were the ones who were on site collecting the data and dealing with the participants. And I had told him that we would use, let's try and standardize this, because our previous studies, this is the way we've done it. But then I think it was purely down to miscommunication that these same instructions were not given to the participants in this study. So they followed something slightly different. This whole experiment, we were very, very short-handed at the same time. It was myself, Yari, and Yari's wife, Tanya Nina, who was working on only the three of us throughout the entire process of this project. So I don't begrudge Yari in any of this, but there was definitely some kind of miscommunication, because his wife was the administrator of the project, so she was the one communicating with the participants, giving them instructions. So somehow the communication between me and Yari got lost in translation, perhaps when it got to the administrator. I take it upon myself, I should have spoken to her directly. Maybe this would have been avoided, then we would have had the same protocol. But yeah,
I think that would influence the results.
I'm pretty sure it does. But I wouldn't think it would influence it that much. Will the pulse wave velocity, for example, show significance as a result if we've had followed the previous?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. Yeah. But we would definitely see changes in other areas. Yeah. As a result of following a certain, because we know also from the first study that some of our participants, another interesting story, some of our participants came in and they wanted to do the sauna, but we had a conversation with them beforehand. You know, they came in early and all that. I was like, oh, I just had a very nice workout earlier today. What? And we said, well, you're not supposed to work out. You're supposed to be abstaining from exercise before you come. So we have to like ask people to come back again and stuff like that. And we knew these things will affect how the results will be reflected, because we know, for example, post-exercise hypotension can last up to 3 hours. So if you already have lowered blood pressure as a result of your prior exercise, then you come into the sauna, A, you might not actually see an effect because your blood pressure levels might already be suppressed. Or B,
what could also happen is you come in and then we see going through the sauna that your body starts to normalize and come and your blood pressure rises back to what it's supposed to be. So these things can have an effect, yeah, in the absolute sense. Yeah.
So what I learned from this is that it's not the easiest to standardize protocol.
No,
a lot of things to think about.
Yeah, a lot of people, a lot of people who will get upset as well.
Yeah. So reading table one, I was a little bit surprised that when I look at aerobic exercise frequency, that almost 50%, they were actually frequent user of exercise 2 to 3 times per week or more. So is this a vascular thing or is this how it looks in Finland?
I'm looking at the room and trying not to make anyone upset. But yeah, it is a central Finland thing. It is a uvascular thing. I think, Hans, you will notice, if we go for a walk later today, as I have noticed, I'm still a bit dumbfounded by it, even till today after 8 years. There are mothers pushing their babies in a pram, running. They're running with their babies in a pram. They're in sports gear, they're in shorts, they're in their exercise gear. And you see that a lot. You see parents cycling, you know, with their kids behind them instead of driving, get an extra seat. I think this is, at least from my observation of what happens in other cities in Finland, that this is somewhat of a, I wouldn't say peculiar, but I would say this is somewhat of a good phenomenon to have. Like there's this pressure. I spoke to many university students from other faculties and they do feel like, wow, everyone here is so healthy, I need to do something as well.
Yeah.
And when we speak to some of our participants who participated in the study, many of them who do exercise very regularly have actually been living here for the past 20 or 25 years. So I think the city has an effect on you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I looked into an evaluation from EU, and you're right that because when you look into the average EU member state, 18% are physically active 3 times or more. But in Finland, 46%, compared to Sweden, it's 31%. So I would say that Finns are physically active in a much greater way than the general population.
Yeah.
EU, yeah.
Okay.
Which is nice.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Let's move to paper 4, effect of regular sauna bathing in conjunction with exercise on cardiovascular function. This is a multi-arm randomized controlled trial. So congratulations, as you said before, you know, this is so important that we do the randomized controlled studies. Because the majority of studies when it comes to sauna, they are small, they are without controls, they are no randomization. So this is explanatory. I like this study a lot. But I have some questions for sure. And one is 90% of the participants were female.
Yes.
Where did you find all those people?
Oops. So a lot of the female, I did not know any of them. I don't know any of them. They were found through health clubs, friends of friends. Like I mentioned earlier, friends of Iris, who's a master's student that assisted me with the study. And it was purely word of mouth. However, it is also, I don't feel like blaming the city for everything, but here goes. The majority of population in New Vascula is in fact female. So there's a larger percentage of females living in New Vascula than there are males. So it is somewhat of a reflection of that. But I understand that it is too gross of a reflection, because 90% is not, that's not right, yeah. One of the problems that we had was the males coming in wanting to do the study, but then they didn't have the requisite, they did not meet our inclusion and exclusion criteria. So a lot of them got eliminated, at least from the beginning. So we did not, and this was all compacted and done in a very short period of time, or rather in quick succession. So we did not have any room to wriggle and say, we saw already during the recruitment process that, oh no, we're going to have a problem because we don't have enough males. But we did not have enough lead time during the recruitment phase to allocate another week to say, let's recruit another 10 male participants, because all the deadlines, it was how things fell in place almost. The facilities, the faculty was available, the students were available to do their research hours and collect the data. The participants were that met the criteria were ready, and we had to get the study going. Yeah, there was no, because the way we planned it was that we wanted to avoid the winter holidays in 2019. So it had to be the, so there's a very specific window of activity for Finnish people, or people living in Finland. Let's not say Finnish people, because I do this too. So they go for their summer vacation, and then they come back somewhere in August. It could be mid-August. Preferably, you want them to be back early August, but they're back mid-August. Then we have the recruitment period. And the recruitment period is short. So we work backwards. So if we didn't want the experiment to go past, because if people go to Christmas, then they're not doing the three times a week, they're not coming to the lab. So we had to have a cutoff point. 15th of December is the last training. And then we need to have 1 week for us to collect the data from the participants, because they had to come into the lab, not for the intervention, but to collect the samples from there. So we worked it out backwards, and we just didn't have time. So we had to just rely on who has met the criteria, and that was how it was.
No, I mean, some studies in females is needed. I mean, the majority are performed in May so far.
That's
it. Has been a nice study, I think, if you had only included females.
Yeah, the supplementary data that's published online has data, and figures, yeah.
So one other question is, if we go to figure two, and you mentioned this earlier on, but what was the rationale to increase the temperature every second week?
Yeah. So the rationale was to ensure that there was a constant progression of thermal load. We did not want, so in fact, there was a part of me that wanted it to be sort of in line with the aerobic exercise progression. So if we look at the same figure two, the aerobic exercise progression was 65% heart rate max for the first 2 weeks. Weeks three and four, 70% heart rate max. Five and six, 75%. And then the final week, final 2 weeks, weeks seven and eight was 80%. So that wasn't the logic behind it, but that was what was achievable. Yeah.
I now jump back again to page 44, because this table 3 is should nicely here show that in study 4 there were more patients with obesity, more with elevated blood pressure, but less with elevated cholesterol. So there is a difference in this group when it comes to risk factors compared to the other studies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Somewhat, slightly. Yes.
Well, not slightly. Yeah. 50% are obese.
Yes.
And 1/3 here have elevated blood pressure.
That's correct.
Okay, but that is how it is. And looking into table one, it might, if we look at the control group, it might also be so that they have more. I haven't checked the statistics, we have a statistician here, but it might be so that, they have more, the control group have more risk factors, is that right?
The control group did have
more risk factors, yes. Significantly more risk factors?
No.
No,
not significantly, but they did have more.
Okay. And then jumping to table three, I think those results are interesting because here exercise and sauna is more effective for increased cardiorespiratory function, lower blood pressure, and total cholesterol. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. How was that in female only? That was a supplement, but it's interesting, I think.
Yeah, it was the same. It was the same.
Did I? If so, what I found when I looked into the supplement was that
cholesterol might have been
exactly.
Yes, cholesterol might have been did not reach statistical significance.
No.
Yes, the trend was there, but it did not reach statistical significance. So we had the same figures, the graphical representations. So. So figure five. So we have figure five for females only in the supplementary figures. And they look, of course, we're just taking two participants away from the group. They look the same. But of course, perhaps I would say it's a matter of the number, not we don't have the number for it to reach the statistical significance, rather than there were no changes in the level per se, if you follow what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, but the result shows that there were no significant lowering cholesterol.
Yes, that is correct. For the females only.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you also, in the frame stories, write that you found improvement in arterial endothelial function in this study, but it was unpublished findings.
Yes. So I am still analyzing that data. I'm still looking at that data because we collected endothelial function using post-occlusive reactive hyperemia. So we assessed the basically blood flow with laser Doppler flowmetry. We have that data, and I'm preliminarily looking at it. It seems that there are some changes there that might have been the reason why some of the things, for example, like blood pressure, were changed. Because, of course, we did not measure baroreflex, so we don't really know if from a neural point of view, if that has changed as a result of sauna bathing, but at least with the unpublished data from the endothelial function, which I hope to get published soon, at least it supports and supplements what we found.
So I was a little bit surprised because exercise and sauna did not show any effect on arterial stiffness.
Yes, it did not. So for me, and as I've said in the article, it's one of two things. One, intervention wasn't long enough.
Mm-hmm.
Two, the changes that we see from a result of the interaction of exercise and sauna are improved function as opposed to change in structure. So structural changes are difficult to achieve in a short period of time. Most of the studies that I've seen that have tried to investigate these kind of changes have been like 20 week long or 24 week long with a follow-up period. And so I do feel like if there were to be any kind of changes structurally, we would need a longer time to investigate that phenomenon. And 8 weeks is, in most clinical related studies, just an early onset. You're just really looking at this is quick in relative to clinically driven intent to treat type of randomized controlled trials. So my guess is that will there be some kind of changes structurally? Possibly. But we would need a longer period of time to investigate this.
Could it be a gender effect?
That's very likely as well. That's very likely as well. Yes. That's very likely. Yes.
But you cannot do statistics to check for that.
We tried.
Okay.
Yeah, but it didn't. Well, the thing here is really we wanted to have more male data so that we can have a clearer picture of everything. But as we all in the room have found out, 2020 wasn't the best year for doing research, or human research at least. I think we can all still go and work with the animals in 2020, but certainly not with the larger ones. So yeah, it was difficult and we couldn't, yeah. There were plans to get, because based on what we saw this data quite early. So we already knew we had an idea of what it's gonna look like, but yeah, we were unable to, again, time to find male participants to supplement this and to run a male-only 8-week intervention again. So
I would like to sum up this now. And if you look in the sauna alone and sauna and exercise groups, how much could the blood pressure be reduced in total?
Could you repeat the question?
So if you look in those groups, how much could you reduce the blood pressure in numbers?
In numbers?
Yeah.
Realistically?
Yeah. No. If you look in the results.
Right.
Yeah.
Eight.
Yeah. Eight. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's around 5 to 8, 9
yeah.
or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Within that confidence interval.
Yeah. 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 Could what can be achieved with medications? Antihypertensive medication.
Depending on the medication, and if you're taking, whether you're taking one or a combination of two, between 5 to 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So almost the same.
Almost the same. Big Pharma's not going to like it.
No, we should, I don't know this, but we should know or look into the costs for antihypertensive drugs. Much more expensive than building saunas in all the houses.
Yeah.
Okay. With all this experience, can you help me to design a standardized protocol now?
For you personally?
No. I mean, for the sauna research community.
Yes, I can. I can. As in a protocol for research or a protocol for the sauna community to follow?
Research.
Research. Absolutely, I can. So, it would be, now that we've already seen with a randomized controlled trial that there are, in fact, interactive effects, so now we can move into sauna bathing proper. And it would be a long-term study. By long, I mean the same kind of long that was employed here, so 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
But I would subject the participants to 15 minutes of sauna, take a shower, 15 minutes of sauna at the lab. You can't do this on your own. You have to come to the lab to do it. That's one group. So 30 minutes. I have another group that does 10, take a shower, 10, take a shower, 10, 30 minutes. And then I will have another group that does 5. So 5 times 6. So all of them 30 minutes. Sauna only. Report your exercise activity, but it will not be used in conjunction with exercise. So you can do your exercise, but you're not supposed to come to the sauna immediately after exercise, because we already know there's an interaction.
Yeah.
So now we just want to find out if these certain specific methodologies will have a difference. Once we get that data, then we'd be able to tell people, we'd be able to give people more solid recommendations. Okay, so you should probably go to the, for example, go to the sauna for 3 rounds, 10 minutes each. That's enough. One of the problems that we have with these kind of study designs is to get people to come. Now, we can circumvent that by using a different approach. I should have some figures to show you guys, but... Okay, why not? I'm going to stand up. Okay. So, me being a teacher and all, so we have 15 times 2, right? We'll call that group A. Now, this is different from what I've just described. So then we have group B, which will be 10 times 2. Then we have group C. So this will be 30 minutes. This will be 20 minutes, and I have group C, 5 times 2, so 10. It could easily be 5 times 3, if you like, and then it will be 15. Why do we do that? Because we want to find out what is the minimum dose required. If we already know that, for example, let's go with the hypothetical, that B, 20 minutes, will give you the kind of effects that you're looking for in terms of health benefit, then we wouldn't need to spend an additional 10 minutes. Unless you really enjoy it, then up to you, do as you please, right? But then you could use that 10 minutes to exercise. So it's a matter of adherence. If it's shorter, people are more willing to do it. Because, oh yeah, it doesn't take so much time, and I get healthy in the same way. So in terms of exploring the length of exposure, keeping all other things constant, I think that's what I would do.
Thank you. I think we have to collaborate on this because creating this protocol would be necessary, I think, for the community. And how can we follow them for a long-term effect?
Yeah, you need to follow them.
Yeah, and what way? I mean, you have been suggesting yourself. Is 8-week protocol, what does that reflect?
Well, the 8-week protocol would definitely tell us about the functional changes, just like it has with study number 4. But I would be interested to collect some biopsies and figure out what's actually happening. So before and after, yeah, because then we open up a different doorway for other research disciplines to come in and interact and give us more knowledge based on their expertise with the molecular mechanisms of heat. Because that's also an area that has been explored in the past 3 years or so. So that's something that if we have a study like that and we collect the samples, the data can be used for collaboration with these researchers who study the molecular mechanisms of heat and then form a better picture and inform the public as well.
So with the climate changes, elderly are at increased risk.
So is there a possibility for heat acclimatization with sauna, with the sauna group, for example, in this group?
Yes. Yes, definitely. I've seen enough studies for me to warrant the use of that to good effect. Yeah. Not only for athletes, but for environmental stress. It has been used, for example, in several studies in Canada, and they have shown that it is effective. Now, because it is well beyond my area of expertise, I can't really speculate how old these people ought to be or what kind of population we're talking about, like with older people. But I would safely assume that between ages of 60 to 70, it's possible.
Yeah, because it can save life, increase quality of life, and
yes,
reduce cost for him.
Absolutely.
So I looked into clinicaltrials.gov, and today there are approximately 20,000 studies on physical activity, 10,000 on high blood pressure. Do you know how many there are on sauna?
Can I just take a wild guess?
Yeah.
I like five. Let's go with five.
Oh. You're right in one way. There are 15, and 13 of those are completed, so three are running right now.
Okay. That, I got close.
You have added four more important studies. I'm very thankful, and I would ask you, what's your personal most important experience of this? Works.
Being completely in the moment with whatever you're doing, whether it is collecting data, talking to the participants, working with your colleagues, writing the research manuscript, and most importantly, learning how to communicate and work with different people towards a common goal. I think that was something that, if I didn't already have before, it was very, very well sharpened. Yeah. Building relationships in order to make something happen.
The studies have any societal impact, I think, or the results of those studies?
I think it already has.
In what way?
People are more interested in finding out how the research was done. I have received a lot of requests to speak about these topics, which now I will guiltily admit I have shoved some of them towards you. So. If you got additional requests, it is because somebody asked me something which I felt you were more of an expert to answer. But there has been an increase in media interest. I think at a societal level, people are understanding that not only is there potential in using this as a way to enjoy your life, because we never... certainly for me, I can speak only for myself. I've never left the sauna feeling pissed off. I've always left the sauna very tired, but with a very dry smile on my face. Like, wow, how good did that feel, you know? So now that we have information to support that as well, that means we are on the right track as a society. And the further we progress this way, the more we can shine that light, and possibly public healthcare authorities and officials will take a look at this and understand that maybe they should put some money towards the study of this particular activity, and then it would bode well even more for the general population, just people who are living, because when you talk about the changing climate,
again, this is one of the things that, that comes to my mind when we use the sauna is, it's not, okay, this is not going to be very popular, but using the sauna is not the greenest activity you can do. It uses a lot of energy. If you light your wooden sauna, you can chop down a lot of trees. That's a fact. But it is enjoyable. If we can, with the research, find out the optimum or the minimum dose, then we are also reducing energy consumption in a way. Because if you no longer have to do, use the sauna for an hour, you wouldn't. You would just use it for 30. Of course, there are going to be people, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot. I would still go to the sauna for an hour and a half. Or 2 hours. I won't really care about the scientific information. That's because I enjoy it very much. But that's not to say that the average person would want to do the same. So at least they will have some information like, oh, it's enough. I only need to do, example, 20 minutes. Why should I go to 30? And many of these users in Finland especially have saunas in their own bathroom. And so with the rising energy costs, it makes sense for them to, if we can get this information, then they save on the electricity consumption as well. So it's a win-win.
So when I was a student in the 80s, I went to the gym and I asked them, why don't you have a sauna? And they said, bodybuilders doesn't. Saunas. And I moved back to the same place 30 years later, went to the same gym, and I was looking to become a member.
Yeah.
And I asked them, do you have a sauna now? No, bodybuilders doesn't do sauna. I would say one social on a societal level is that I would say that it should be almost mandatory for the gym or the exercise locations to have a sauna as well as a treadmill or bicycle.
Yes, that is correct. I couldn't agree with you more. I think we need to speak to some sauna manufacturers about this possible expansion.
Yeah.
And a big expansion too, because as we have spoken about before, the saunas that we normally see in health clubs and health centers are not the most they can get a bit claustrophobic, so they don't really build the sauna with a good size. I almost feel like they put the sauna in as a way to say yes, we do have a sauna, as opposed to building a sauna purposefully as part of a supplement for exercise. So yeah, that's something that we definitely should explore further and get more traction.
So to conclude, I would like to congratulate you again for this excellent and important. I hope you will continue in this field and increase the number of studies for prevention and also for actually therapy in the future. So thank you very much for this nice piece of work.
Thank you very much, Professor Hans, for making the time to perform this detailed examination.
So I will now submit the dissertation to the faculty for approval.
If anyone here has any critical comments to make on my dissertation, please ask the custos for the floor.
No questions. The public examination is closed.
I would now like to invite everyone present here today for coffee and cake outside the hall. Mm-hmm.